I was walked up in front of the judge, and I was nervous, shaking, nervous, and she began reading something to me. Then I realized she's reading my letter to me. And so immediately tears fall from my eyes, and I get emotional every time I talk about it, because by the end of it, she told me, I'm going to give you a chance. You're not the right candidate for my court, but I'm going to give you a chance, and I'm hoping you won't make a fool out of me. I'm actually a graduate of our adult felony drug court here in Midland County. One of my best experiences ever. It's something I'll remember forever. It's the most important to me, is walking across the stage for graduation from the program. The specialty court program is really what gave me the tools, the motivation, the time to make that life change. I'm working on 6 years sober.
That was a quick peek of the conversation we will be having with Jennifer McMorris on the podcast today. Stay tuned to hear more about her inspirational journey from violent offender to drug court participant, then graduate, and now peer support specialist within the same court program she participated in. Our discussion provides insight into addiction and recovery, and how self-discovery can play a big role in sobriety. So buckle up, and let's go on a ride with the podcast to Midland County, Texas.
Let's get started. Can you give your name, your current role, and a website where people can go to learn more?
Yeah, my name is Jennifer McMorris. My current role here at the CSCD is a responsivity specialist. I'm also certified with the state of Texas as a recovery support peer specialist. A website to learn more would be MidlandCSCD.net, specifically under the specialty courts tab.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us on the show today. I am really excited about our discussion today, and I think that the audience is really in for a treat to be able to hear from you and learn from you, and I really appreciate you joining us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Before we dig too far into the work that you're doing with in Midland County, I'd like to just talk about you as a person and kind of just a brief history about your experiences in life that led you to where you are now.
Oh man, so where do I start? I'm in recovery myself. I'm working on 6 years sober. I'm actually a graduate of our adult felony drug court here in Midland County. That is one of my best experiences ever. It's something I'll remember forever. It's the most important to me. Is walking across the stage for graduation from the program. I have a long history of substance use and in and out of jail. I've been to prison. I've definitely struggled with different mental health issues, and I've lost everything multiple times and had to rebuild. The specialty court program is really what gave me the tools, the motivation, the time to make that life change, the support and the love, and you know, to where I'm at today is amazing. If you would have asked me 6, 7, 8 years ago if I would ever be doing what I'm doing right now, I probably would have laughed in your face. Maybe used some colorful language. I went from being a very angry and violent offender that most people didn't want to deal with to who I am today, which is definitely all God, not Jennifer. Some of my favorite roles in life today are being a wife and being a mother. God has blessed me with such a great personal life, as well as just opened many doors of opportunity to continue helping others. Where I found my passion is helping others in recovery, or even just with any life struggles or mental health. And so this is kind of a dream come true for somebody like me.
First of all, congratulations on 6 years.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is a journey. I imagine life does look really different than it did, you know, 7+ years ago, but I've heard great things about you, and that's how it led me to asking you to be on the show and sharing your story with us. You're making an impact on a lot of people's lives.
Oh, thank you.
Well deserved.
I can only help one person get to a different place in life, than I've done my job. A lot of this is just naturally wanting to be there to support others who have struggled like I have.
I'm going to take a break from talking about all that deep stuff for just a moment. but I've given you a warning. I'm actually going to go back into some of that. But let's talk a little bit about your current job that you have now.
So So as a responsivity specialist, it's really cool. I mean, I do a multitude of things. But basically, I act as a peer specialist to support others, but I get to work with our treatment program and then with our specialty courts and then those that are on high risk or low risk probation. So we do what we call a TAD5 assessment to gauge whether somebody may or may not have a substance use disorder. All of the probation office has access to these. And so whenever they see a concern with their clients, they can fill out one of those, which will land on my desk, and I'll get to score and kind of evaluate and look at the client's history and set an appointment with them to kind of visit with them about where they're at. And so for regular probationers, those on high risk or low risk or even transfer-ins, and that's my favorite part of it, is the transfer-ins. I think everybody kind of knows if you're a transfer-in client, you miss some of the resources, right? Because you have a different supervising county. So that's my favorite to be able to reach to. But I get to sit with them, kind of see where they're at, and connect them with different resources in our community that might help them be better successful on probation. So hopefully you make an impact and intervene enough that they don't have to keep continuing this walk. That doesn't always happen. That's, of course, the big vision, what everybody would hope for. But it's really cool to meet with them and get them connected. For our specialty court program, of course, is where that's my heart. So I love to, I attend court when I can. I connect with them. I'm also the alumni president. So we have our autonomous alumni meetings every Friday evening at a local recovery community organization. And we get to connect with them and mentor those in the program and help them where they're struggling and give them encouragement and lift them up. You know, for some of those, you know, I can help advocate for them for if our TAP treatment isn't working, I can get them connected to something else in the community that might be better fit for them. If they're being misunderstood in court, I can help bring the understanding with, you know, advocacy for them. You know, if they're struggling, if they don't understand, if they don't understand their probation officer, I love trying to help them bridge that gap, right? Because it's always the probationer across the table that doesn't understand why a probation officer is either saying what they're saying, making them do what they're going to need them to do, all the requirements that are placed on their life. And I get to bring some understanding of why they're doing what they're doing, that bringing that communication and empowering them and encouraging them to communicate and advocate for themselves. Like if something's not working, speak on that. If something is bothering you, speak on that. And so just empowering them to speak up and let them know, because this is their journey. This is their path, and they have to continue life beyond the program. And so what do they want out of it? Because I think their human inclination is to come in here and tell the treatment team or the probation officers or the judge what they want to hear, what they think they want to hear. And they don't open up. They don't want to be exposed or vulnerable to talk about the things that they want, afraid that that's not what they're going to let them do or what they think they should do. And so I get to help them see that this is their journey. They're in control of that. They've got to work towards the things they want to work towards, because they have to live life beyond the program too. So I get to do a number of things. I come in contact. There's some different intervention points that we put in place. So I hold a peer support group every Thursday. Those are for what I call the newcomers that are fresh and new to the specialty court program. And it's specialty court specific. And we have three different specialty courts. We have the adult felony drug court, the DWI court, and the TTC court that I'm involved in. And so that peer group is specifically for them, for the newcomers. And so I invite other alumni in the group to facilitate group. I invite our local recovery community organization peer specialists to come and participate in the group, so they get bridging the gaps between the program and the community. Then I also have an aftercare peer group. That's for those that are further along in treatment, are fixing a discharge from treatment, or have discharged from treatment. So they can participate, and it's open for all. So regular probationers and specialty court. And so it's really cool to see them connect. Those are the big things with those two groups, is to help bring understanding to what they're going through, and connect with others so they can support each other through the program. I also visit with observers when they come to observe the court. So they get to apply for the court once they've been greenlighted by the DA, their application's been approved. They have the opportunity to observe the court to see if they want to move forward. I get to come and talk to them and answer questions and kind of share my experience along with several other alumni that participate in that, which is really cool. I usually facilitate intakes for all new clients coming into treatment. So I get to share, again, my experience there, help bring understanding to what's being required of them and what they can expect in the program. So there's a lot of different roles I get to play and connect with all participants, both in our treatment program, treatment court program, and with our regular probationers.
That is a lot of things that you're doing. And more importantly, like, it's like through the entire process, from the beginning of the process through the end of the process. You are
absolutely,
you're involved in these people's lives. How long have you been in this role?
So I've actually only been in this role for a little over a year. Prior to being hired at the probation office here with the treatment team, I worked for the local recovery community organization, Thriving United. And so even there, I was very involved in court. I've been involved in court since graduated. I would go back and I would just sit in the open court sessions and talk with people. That's always been, they couldn't get rid of me. They made a believer out of me and they couldn't get rid of me. So I attended all the time. And so when I got the job at Thriving United, it was a huge blessing because I got to be more involved and got paid for it. You know, at Thriving, I got to come over here once a week and be in office with the treatment team and work with some of the clients out of this office. And that's kind of how this role was created. They saw the benefit in it. The agency director talked to me about, agency director and my supervisor right now, talked to me about working over here full time, basically doing what I was doing with a little more. And I was so excited to make the transition. So now I kind of bring that bridge between probation, specialty court, and Thriving United still, because I'm still so well connected. So I've been able to work with the court in some nature, you know, as a job between Thriving United and probation for the last 3 or 3.5 years.
Was it your time through the specialty court program that like inspired you to do this work? Or were you doing anything in this field at all before your time at the specialty court?
Oh, no, definitely was not doing anything. I think before being accepted to the specialty court program, one, I was accepted from jail. But prior to being in jail, I don't think I had worked legitimately. You know, I sold drugs, I ran the streets, I ran drugs for probably 5 years before being accepted into the program. I hadn't had a job in 5 years. And so, yeah, I would say my experience through the court is what opened up my heart and passion for helping others. I think when I was about 10 months sober, I can remember telling my counselor when I was in the program, I'm going to be a counselor one day, and I'm going to be a counselor working for this same program. And so God's opened those doors and led me to do those things. I'm currently in school in our licensed chemical dependency program to become an LCDC at some point, and just waiting for God to reveal how that's going to come into play. So I'm taking school very slowly because I do have the full-time job, and then I love my role as a, you know, as a wife and a mother. So I'm doing it very slowly. So I've been in school for probably 2.5 years, and I still got probably 2 or 3 more semesters to go, but well worth it. And so this is definitely my experience in the program. If they could help me make that major life change that I needed to not spend 10 years or die on the streets, not spend 10 years in prison, not being institutionalized, then I'm a fan. You know what I mean? I want to help others do the same thing. I want to help others experience what I've experienced and give them what I was freely given to.
Speaking from somebody who took 10 years to get my 2-year degree, just stick with it.
and you're going to get there. And
Oh, yes.
I think putting your family first is so important. You know, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. But I think continuing to work on that, obviously there's a reason why you're on that journey and a reason why it's calling you to be on that path. And so I'd say just stick with it. But regardless of how much time it takes, if you keep feeling like that's where you're supposed to be, then just keep with it. But you're doing the right thing, making sure you're balancing that with everything else.
It's totally crazy because I love being a peer specialist. I love the connection, the more laid back and friendly environment or connection that brings with those with clients. But I've been led to be in school for counseling. So I'm really curious to see what God does that at the end of it. I know I'm supposed to finish. I know that's I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, but I love my role as a peer specialist as well. So it's kind of weird. I don't know where it's going, but we'll see.
We will see. I look forward to seeing where that leads you. So you've kind of shared a few things that I want to follow back up on. I want to talk about your time in the specialty court program. I feel like we're kind of going backwards a little bit.
That's okay.
I'm starting like with your current role and then like, let's talk about your time in the program itself.
Sure.
So that was about 6 years ago or 6+ years ago. Does that sound about right when you started?
So I graduated the program March of 2020. And then I was released early from probation later that year.
Let's talk about how you ended up in the program. Let's start there. Like,
sure.
You said that you got accepted from jail.
It's a crazy story. It's a crazy, crazy story on how I got in the program. So I was accepted from the county jail. But before that, when I initially got the charges, was probably almost 2 years before I was accepted. You know, I got arrested and got in trouble for 3 different possession charges. And I started the court process and they were offering me 10 years on my background based on, you know, they enhanced me and I tried to negotiate between my attorney and the DA and they knocked it down to 8 years. And I tried to do the right thing by showing up because I knew my life was out of control. I knew I just had that gut feeling that, you know, it was either going to be a very long time in prison or death. Thought that the lesser of the evils would be prison. At least I wouldn't be dead. And it's crazy to think like that. But so I was going to show up. I intended to show up to court. And when it came down to the court to go in and sign in for 8 years, because that's all they would go for, I couldn't do it. I didn't do it. And so I ran for a year and a half before they caught up with me in a little town outside of Midland called Gardendale. And I remember being pulled over and I had been pulled over before during the time of running from the law and I would lie about who I was and got away with it. But this time it was like that peace came over me of like, it's time. It's time to go face the music. You can't live like this anymore. You know, during that time I ran, life got so low to where I, for the first time, knew what starving looked like, knew what being without necessities and different items that you need looked like, what stealing just to eat looked like. Things, I was so paranoid of getting caught that my life just fell completely apart. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't trust anybody. And so when we were getting pulled over, it was almost like peace came over me and I knew it was time. And so I freely gave my name, freely told him I had warrants out of Midland County. He went and checked him and I will never forget the state trooper, although I don't remember his name, but I will never forget his face. You know, I was a violent offender. And so usually it was pulling me out of the car, handcuffing my hands behind my back, putting me in the back seat and detaining me for any and every reason because of the name I made for myself. He was so nice. He asked me to step out. He handcuffed me in the front and then he opened the front door of his cruiser. And I thought it was all a trick. Like, I don't want to sit up there. I want to sit in the back. And he said, just get in. And so he talked to me the whole way about, do you want to know what your charges are? Do you know if you want to know if there's bond set? And I'm like, I don't care what your computer screen. Once I get there, they're not going to let me out. And he was just so nice to me. And said some of the most nice and empowering and encouraging words about, you know, he could see and feel that I did not belong in the lifestyle that it looks like I was leading, and that he knew I would be doing great things once I faced this music, and that everything was going to go be okay, and I was meant for better things in life. And so, of course, I cried the whole way. But once I got to, they took me to Ector County Jail first. It was almost like that freeing feeling. Like I was free. I no longer had to starve. I no longer had to be without a place to lay my head. Yeah, I had access to restrooms and all my necessities. Everything was, I just felt better already. And that was probably the first time I hit my knees and told God, I was ready. I'm ready for whatever you have in store. So I slept, and then they transferred me to Midland County. Again, I was like, I knew everything was okay. I was already accepting that it would be a while before I got back in front of the district judge, and they would probably go back to 10 years. And so I get back in, you know, general population in Midland County. I get comfortable, and I'd been there probably a month, and I wake up, got real connected with God during this time, was really acceptant of what was going to happen in my fate with the judicial system. And I woke up one morning, and somebody during the time I was asleep had posted, you know, a sign on a wall right near my bunk that was explaining drug court and how to apply and who could be accepted. And the girl that was staying above me, she said, "That's what you should do. If you want what you say you want, you should apply." And on there it said that there was special requirements, right? And so I had talked to my attorney, and even the cool thing about my attorney came to be my attorney because he was my court-appointed attorney before I ran, and he saw that I was in the jail, and he came and said he was going to try to get back on my case, and he did. So he was my new court-appointed attorney, and also, but I talked to him about it, and he told me, "Jennifer, you won't qualify. You're a violent offender. They don't take violent offenders." And I was defeated, and then he looked at me and he said, "But you should try, but just don't get your hopes up." And so I did. I filled out an application. I wrote the letter to the judge, and you know, in jail, they tell you to write three: one to keep, so like a copy; one to send to your attorney, and that's another copy; and then send one with the judge in your application. And so I did. I wrote those three copies of the letter. I sent everything in. A few weeks later, you know, I got a letter back saying I was denied because of my background. I was, you know, defeated, upset. And one of the girls in the tank told me the next day is, "You should apply again. Don't take no for an answer." And so I did it again. I wrote all three letters again, sent in another application about a little bit longer. So like 3 or 4 weeks later, I got another denial, and I was threw my hands up and said, I'm done. I'm okay. I was okay with my time before I started this. I'm not doing it again." And my visit with my attorney, and he told me, "Try again." And I was so frustrated because I didn't understand why people were telling me to keep trying. But in prayer, you know, God told me to listen to the suggestions. And so I did. I filled out again, wrote three letters, application, sent it in. It seemed to be a long time the last time. And then all of a sudden I was being called for court. And so I was nervous that I was being called for district court before hearing back from the third application. And when I got over to the courthouse, I wasn't in district court. I was in on the first floor in what I called the the Gates of Heaven courtroom. It's our commissioner courtroom, but that's where they held the specialty court at first. But it was just the judge, the compliance officer, and a court coordinator. I was walked up in front of the judge, and I was nervous, shaking, nervous. And she began reading something to me. Then I realized she's reading my letter to me. And so immediately tears fall from my eyes. And I get emotional every time I talk about it, because by the end of it, she told me, "I'm going to give you a chance. You're not the right candidate for my court, but I'm going to give you a chance, and I'm hoping you won't make a fool out of me." And so then I told her, you know, I would give it my best shot, and I couldn't promise I couldn't make a fool out of her, but this is definitely something I wanted. And so I go back to the jail, or I sign paperwork. I go back to the jail. They're going to let me out, or no, they're going to do my screenings. And so they did all my screenings. I met with a probation officer. I met with a counselor for all my screenings. I found out I was accepted and they were going to release me, but I was so scared. And I can remember telling the corrections officer in the jail, I told her, I can't do it. I'm just going to stay here. I'd rather just do my time. I'm more comfortable here. I know I can stay sober. I have less chance of screwing this up. And she said, you're going to be great. And so she walked me out. And it took me all of about 48 hours before I relapsed and went on a binge for 2 weeks. And I remember calling my probation officer. I was sitting in Walmart parking lot. I sat in somebody else's car, whoever left their car unlocked. And I called my probation officer and said, here's where I am. Come and get me. I'm done. I can't do this. And she told me, Jennifer, just come and see me. And my thoughts were, I'm not coming to you. You got to come find me. But I did. I went and saw her. Her and my counselor at the time, I felt like trapped me in the office, trapped me in a corner, and told me that we were going to get through this. They believed in me and I had great potential. And I just cried. And all I wanted to do was get out of that office. And that was probably the first time someone had told me that they believed in me, or the second time with the state trooper, in a very, very long time. And so that was my breaking moment. That was when I decided I was going to change. And so my first clean UA was 11/5/2018, which is my sober date today. It was a roller coaster ride through the program. I was one of the first 10 picked for the program. Judge calls us the pioneers. I call us the guinea pigs because there was a lot of changes and they kind of figured out what to do and what not to do with all of us. And I think I was really lucky to be one of the first because I'm sure there was many times that, you know, they probably would have sent me off had I been further along in the program and they got more stable and balanced. But my time in the program was amazing. You know, the four people that I connected with in the program, I still talk to today. We all graduated. You know, I was one of the first three to graduate and walk across the stage. And that is so, so important to me. You know, I did graduate high school, but I barely remember that. I wasn't very sober walking across the stage, didn't really care about it, barely made it by in high school. But I will forever remember my drug court graduation. And I still have my certificate, the coin that I got. And each year, you know, when I gain a coin for my length of sobriety, I pass it on to a new participant or someone that speaks to me to let them know it's that sign of hope that you can do it too. And when you get to this point and you get your own coin, you pass it to somebody else. My time in the program it was the best. It was ups and downs. It wasn't easy, but they worked with me. They treated me like I was a human. They treated me like I had potential. It was life-changing.
Your story is very inspirational, Jennifer. So
thank you
for sharing that. Do you remember the name of the judge that read your letter to you?
Mm-hmm. She's still the judge today, Judge Elizabeth Rainey.
I know her. She is on the board with me on the Texas Association of Special Courts. And
she is. Yes, ma'am.
She is. Amazing person. You know, I have to say, I really, really hope one day that you get the opportunity to meet that trooper again, or that the trooper at least knows at some point the impact he made by treating you the way that he treated you that day, and the way that he talked with you, and that he believed in you. And I think it's amazing that through your whole story, how many people saw something in you when you didn't see it inside yourself. And I think you sharing that when you were in your probation officer's office, to have people believe in you when you're in like your darkest moments. You're not in your, you know, you're not sober at the time and people are like, yeah, I believe you can continue to be sober. It's you're in your darkest moments and yet somebody's looking at you and saying they still see a light inside of you and they still see that you have that potential and that you're actually going to go somewhere. And it wasn't necessarily that you were going to, like with the trooper, for instance, you weren't going to be clean the next day. You know, you were clean because you were in jail. But you recognized that being released was going to lead to you disappointing people, right? You weren't ready. And
yeah.
That journey, though, I just, I'm going back to that moment where you said you just felt that peace come over you and you gave your name, your real name this time, knowing that you were going to be brought in. And it just seems like something was telling you that was the journey you needed to go on now. Fast forward to where you are now. Fast forward to not just your career, which is an amazing journey itself, and not just the fact that you're in school, you know, for counseling and stuff, but your home life, your entire life, all of this just kind of unfolded going down this journey. So I'm so happy for you. Sorry.
Thank you.
I'm so happy for you. Sometimes the hardest part is just sticking with something, right? Is just
for
continuing,
sure.
continuing in light of challenges along the way. And I have no doubt that you had many challenges along the way. Let's take a quick break. Did you know that Mental Health Awareness Month was established in 1949? The purpose was to increase awareness of the importance of mental health and wellness in the lives of Americans, and also to celebrate recovery from mental illness. For more than 20 years, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, otherwise known as SAMHSA, has recognized Mental Health Awareness Month every May to increase awareness about the vital role mental health plays in our overall health and well-being. SAMHSA also provides resources and information to support individuals and communities who may need mental health support. One resource is SAMHSA's 2024 Mental Health Awareness Toolkit. The toolkit is designed to make it easier for you to spread awareness by sharing materials with your audience and across your social media channels. Some of the materials are even customizable. Find the direct link to the toolkit in the show notes. Learn more on SAMHSA's website. When you were in the program, do you remember any of your experiences? So you talked about your intake process, your application process. You did the screenings you mentioned. Do you remember much about what that screening process was like for you?
Yeah, I remember. So, you know, the screenings in the jail, you know, they tell you you're going to be assessed, right? And so my former probation officer, which is now, it's really crazy. Everything's full circle. The judge is one of my closest friends. The compliance officer, we're, you know, practically family at this point. And my probation officer then is now the supervisor for the specialty court supervision side. And so we're close friends too. But I always tease her, right? Because when she came, she wasn't having a very good day. And so when I was doing my assessment and there was a loud fan in the hallway, I was so excited to be assessed by her. Her face said everything was like she was not happy at the time. And I thought to myself, if that's my probation officer, I'm screwed. And she was one of the most impactful people along my journey. It was so crazy. And so I always tease her about that, that I thought she was so mean and she was going to be so mean. And she was the most impactful person. And, you know, one of the real big reasons that I made that decision, that the whole turn of events with that one conversation with her and my counselor, you know, a few days before my sobriety date, it's nuts. But yeah, I remember the assessments. The counselor that assessed me were coworkers, and I absolutely adore her. Miss Pearl was so sweet coming in. We went from Shelby that looked like she was having a horrible day and looked very mean and intimidating to Miss Pearl, who was just sweet and nurturing. And we talked about my history, and she told me that my history definitely looks like it qualifies. And so it was a crazy, the assessments were, they made me very anxious, you know, that anticipation of whether you're going to be accepted or if you're a good candidate for the program, all those things. But yeah, I remember them pretty vividly.
Did they ask you questions that were difficult to answer?
Absolutely. You know, even in the assessment given by the probation officer, it was hard. I mean, by the probation officer, but also by the counselor, when the more deep substance use questions, I think just like every other new participant or potential participant in the program, I didn't tell the complete truth. I tried to, but some of that stuff was so hard to talk about and so buried. and that you just don't want to see the look on the person across the table from you if you're completely honest. So there was definitely things that were hard to disclose.
Yeah, I imagine. What about once you got into the program, did you experience any sanctions at all through your time at the court?
Several. The ones that were most impactful, and I made jokes about today, creatinine. I had like six different drug patches over creatinine. I had been sober for a little bit. My kidneys don't work the best anyways. I've got some health issues, and this was kind of the beginning of really finding out the different health issues that I was going to have to start taking care of. And every time she put that patch on me, I knew it was $60 more. But it wasn't about just that. It was about, you don't believe me? You don't believe that I'm sober? It was horrible to get those sanctions over the creatinine, because back then I only understood it as, you're giving me a sanction over water. It took, me a long time to research it, really understand it, and be in this role to learn more about it today, to be able to also be there with other clients that are experiencing those positive creatines and what could be going on, and giving understanding to that. But I was so mad at her for one of those patches that I was cussing in court, and the compliance officer kicked me out of the courtroom and told me to wait outside, and I got in trouble for my mouth in court. And I was so upset over these patches for creatinine. And she explains to me today, there's some decisions that are made to prove what you're saying, not to disprove what you're saying. And so that brought a lot of insight into it, but I only felt like she didn't believe I was sober and that I kept having to prove my sobriety. It was hard and not when you don't have that understanding. So that's kind of what I get to bring to the table for clients now in the program, participants. Sometimes there's things that happen to try to prove what you're saying.
Can you explain what CREAT is exactly?
Oh, let's see, get my best go at it. So
not like the official CREAT description, but just for those of us who are not familiar with that term.
So there's courts. I don't think all courts, but I think most courts try to, they test for low levels of creatinine, which could be a sign of somebody trying to flush, large amount of liquids flush in their system to pass a UA. Your body naturally produces creatinine and at variable times. Your kidneys do. They release creatinine and not release creatinine. So your body naturally fluctuates, but the courts will test for low creatinine as a sign of flushing.
So it's a way to ensure that when they're doing their drug tests on participants and the drug tests are saying that you're clean, they're ensuring that you haven't done any sort of flushing to create that clean drug test.
Correct. Yeah. The manipulation. Yeah.
Okay. Do you remember having any incentives during your time there?
A lot of the incentives that I remember, because incentives it's not a brand new thing to the court, but that's what's really cool. When I first was hired here, I got to go to a DWI conference in San Marcos, and they talked about the incentives and what it does for the court. And judge had implemented her coin system and incentive clause already, but I was so pumped up, like, we are going to bring all the incentives. So now we do so many things that she maybe rolled her eyes at me at first, but it's been such a benefit and impact in the court that she is all game for incentives now. But back then when I was in the court, the incentives were more like the verbal praise from judge, right? Pleasing her, pleasing your counselor and your probation officer, the phase ups, those kinds of different things. The cool thing about the incentives I get to see today with participant is watch that reward become so big and so impactful in that moment, in that day on their journey. And so it's really kind of cool. The incentives then weren't like the incentives now.
In your experience, when you were going through the court, was there that, it seems obvious from what you shared so far, that desire to please everybody, to not disappoint people anyway, right? Not disappoint the people that seem to be really believing in you in that moment.
Absolutely.
But did you find that that was help motivate you through the program?
Oh yeah. I mean, the three biggest impact, right, on a participant's life, especially mine, was the judge, my counselor, and my probation officer. And so hearing that I'm doing well and I'm progressing well, even when I didn't feel like it, was motivating. When the compliance officer had more friendly visits coming to your door, that was motivating. When I was able to begin, mending and healing relationships with family and loved ones that I had burnt so many bridges with, and my children, when my children wanted to be around me and wanted to talk to me, that was motivating. I always say the first 6 months is kind of you're on auto. I was on autopilot. I wasn't really comfortable with who I was. In fact, that was probably almost until I was almost a year sober. I wasn't comfortable with who I was. I didn't know who I was sober. I only knew who I was high. I can remember sitting in treatment class one night, and the group facilitator gave all of us a paper, and it was all about, what's your name? What's your favorite movie? What's your favorite food? What's your favorite color? And I got so frustrated because I didn't know those things. I didn't know what my favorite food was. I had no idea what my favorite color was. I didn't know those things about myself. And I was got so overwhelmed, so anxious, I got up and threw the paper away. And I had to talk those things through with my counselor, but I had no idea the things that I like to do. I lost myself so much in addiction and the lifestyle that I was leading. Those things weren't at the forefront of my mind. I couldn't even remember what they were prior to me, getting head deep in the lifestyle. It was crazy.
What about the times that you had to go to the court during the court program? Because at this point you're released from jail. What was your housing? Let's start there. What was your housing like at the beginning of the program?
I didn't have anywhere to go. So I'd asked during my assessment if there was a possibility of me doing an inpatient treatment before, right after jail, because I didn't have anywhere to go. And at the time, the court was new. And so what they wanted to do was me to try the program first, and then we would talk about inpatient if needed once I was released. They knew I didn't really have anywhere to go. I had reached out to my mom when I was accepted, and she was going to graciously let me come stay with her. But at the time, I knew in my gut that was a bad thing to do. Me and my mom's relationship was not a healthy relationship. It was very toxic, and we couldn't get along, and my kids were there. But that's what I was going to do. That's where I could go. So she picked me up from jail, and in that first 48 hours when I said I relapsed, that was fight with my mom over the small things to I ran away and did what I wanted to do. And so I then again didn't have anywhere to stay. So I tried to stay once they were going to work with me. I tried to stay at a friend's house that I knew, but of course she used. And so that made it difficult for me to stay sober in that 2 weeks. And then it was again God showing up. There was another girl in the program that I had known and went to school with, and her mom and her family invited me to stay with them until I found somewhere else to stay. And so that's what gave me my leg up, right? I had a sober place to stay that wasn't going to further damage the relationship with my kids and my mom, that I could focus on myself and sobriety. And so I stayed with them, I would say 6 or 7 months until I was able to get my own apartment.
Do you find that that's something that current participants struggle with still, is finding sober living while they're in the program?
Absolutely. In Midland, it's pretty rare or scarce for sober living spots. We've got two. There's only really one women's. Well, there's three. There's Oxford House, Springboard Sober Living, and Thriving United has some recovery residences. Two out of three of those will also take women. Oxford House currently doesn't have a women's home in Midland. So it makes it difficult because even if they're in Odessa, which is, a mere 15 miles from Midland, 15, 20, it makes it difficult if they have transportation barriers to get back and forth daily for their UAs to court every week, to their probation officer, to treatment groups. because with transportation barriers usually comes financial barriers. So it's definitely difficult. I definitely wish that we could have a sober living just specifically for drug court. That's a dream, right? So it would make it easier on some of those. But it's really cool. The court now has really good relationships with the Salvation Army and all three of those sober livings to try to gain placement for current participants.
So at the beginning of the program, when you finally do get sober living, the times that you had to go repeatedly, because that's actually, I'm glad you brought up the issue of having to go to all the different things that you have to do, right? And the transportation. Did you find yourself struggling with any of that as well during the beginning of the program to get to court, the frequency of the time that you need to be in the courtroom, the times you need to meet with your probation officer, any of that?
Of course, it was a struggle. You know, when I lived with my friend and her family, her mom and dad took us to meet all of our requirements, right? We were doing the same treatment groups, so that made it easy. They graciously provided transportation when we had to meet with our probation officers, UA, and to court. But when I got my own apartment, you know, my transportation was riding a bus and walking. You know, I didn't get a car, wasn't able to get a car until I was probably 10 or 11 months sober. And so I spent the majority of the year either, you know, riding with them or walking and riding the bus. And that was difficult for me. That was humbling for me. That was part of my journey, though. Right? I can remember getting on the bus the first time and I had a hoodie on. And I put the hood over and sunglasses on because I was so afraid for somebody to drive by and see me riding a bus. For whatever reason, that was humiliating for me. And so it was very humbling. And then walking everywhere, you would have never seen me do that before. I never would have been walking from place to place or riding the bus. But that was all a big part of my journey. It made me resourceful. It helped me to be responsible. It helped me to, you know, to humble myself, to get the things done that I needed to get done.
When you were continuing through the program and you were going through the phases of the program, did you ever worry that you weren't going to be successful to go from one phase to the next?
Oh, absolutely. I think I started gaining more confidence at a year sober in myself. The rest of it, it's just like when people would tell you things, it's like it was motivating, but I didn't really believe it. It didn't really resonate. When I got my 1 year chip sober, it was like, oh man, maybe I really can do this. And I started to gain that confidence in my journey. I always had that secret fear of I'm going to disappoint yet some more people and I'm going to fail, that I can't do this. There's no way I can be sober. You know, prior to the program, I couldn't see what life looked like sober. As much as I wanted a normal existence without the drama, without the strife, without the struggle, I couldn't see myself sober ever.
When you got to your graduation day, can you share a little bit about what that day was like for you? Because I know you said that you'll never forget that day.
Oh, I'll never forget it. Here in Midland County, we have a really cool graduation ceremony. It's like anything you would see even in a high school graduation, right? It's you walk across the stage, you receive your certificate and your coin of achievement for the program. You know, walking across that stage, I remember my legs were shaking the entire time. And then I had already been in tears. And then, you know, Judge, she says these wonderful things about your journey through the program. And it's the hug that she gives you. I mean, it was so accomplishing. You know, if I had a graduation hat, I would have thrown it in the air just like they do at normal high school graduations. But it was so accomplishing. And I was an emotional wreck because I had actually made it. So it was very cool. It's a very cool experience. It's still my favorite experiences. I attend every graduation. The alumni now has a portion of the graduation where they can do a send-off. I call it a send-off speech. It's that encouragement speech for those current graduates that to stay connected, to keep going, that your journey's not over, and you know how proud we are as alumni of those that are graduating again. So it's pretty cool.
Did you have an alumni group when you graduated?
No.
Did you start the alumni group at that point, or did that, is that something that came later?
So it wasn't right after graduation, but there was three of us, one of the girls I graduated with, and another girl that was soon to be graduating, that worked. She's the founder or co-founder of Thriving United. We all three got together and we started a group, and it was the first and third Fridays at 5:45. And we did that. We've done it for a while, so it's been several years now. And now it's gained traction and we've got more involvement, more coming to the groups. The courts, always been very supportive of it. The probation officers are very supportive of it now. It's really cool to see how it's growing, and how they support each other. It wasn't too long ago when, one of the participants came to the group and she was just sharing that she was going through car troubles and all this stuff, and the entire group passed a basket to donate money towards her car troubles, and she was able to get a new car, to put a down payment on a new car. And that's how powerful and impactful that group is. And it's just amazing to see how far it's come.
How long were you in the program total?
So I believe I was 16 or 17 months total in the program.
When you graduated, wonderful day, right? Like you said, you were a mess. It was an emotional experience, right? At any time around that period, were you worried about relapsing once you, knowing that you were done with the program, were you concerned at all?
There's always that fear that something will happen. Like, I don't have my support anymore. But I was, with the peer connections that we had, just the continued love and support from the team. I had a fear, of course. I was so afraid what would happen after, but I was also confident because if I could make it to the stage, what else could I do? And I was so motivated at the time to help others. And again, they couldn't get rid of me. So I continued to attend courts and get connected with those in the court. And then we started hearing about alumni groups and all that stuff, and then started talking to Jen and Tara about this, putting an alumni group together. It's just kind of, it was, just all really cool. I mean, I was pretty confident. I was worried. I'm always aware that at any point somebody can get wrapped up in something and relapse. So I'm aware of that, but it's really weird, the freedom that God has given me through my journey and the confidence that he's given me in supporting others. That's helped alleviate a lot of that fear of relapse.
That's really good. What kind of treatment did you receive during the program?
So it was an intensive outpatient treatment that I went through, and it's our treatment alternative to incarceration program. Same team that I work with now. I mean, there's some new people, but same program that's been well evolved. But yeah, it was those treatment groups, intensive outpatient. So I was in groups, starting off, 3 days, 4 days a week. So we had 3 days, and then we had a peer support group on a Thursday. And so, there was 4 days a week I was here. Sometimes five, depending on when I saw my probation officer and how many times I had a UA. So I went through that. I don't remember how long I was actually in treatment and in counseling, but pretty much the most of the time. But I as you progress in phases, there was, of course, less treatment groups you had to participate in. Ended when I was just, doing outpatient with a counselor. So I luckily never attend had to attend an inpatient or a long-term treatment. But back then those options were, the court was still building and was still getting those resources and making those connections. So it wasn't as a readily available resource at the time, or I think I probably would have experienced inpatient, but luckily intensive outpatient and outpatient care was sufficient enough for me.
Do you remember through all of that treatment if there was any moments that really resonated with you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, so the biggest growth and learning that I can remember was learning about, healthy relationships, because most of the relationships in my life were very toxic, whether they be intimate relationship, friendships, or family relationships. They were just very unhealthy. Another powerful thing was to learn that I was the problem. Nobody else was. The world wasn't. It was me. And so I needed to do some changing. That was insightful. But the biggest learning for me was the anger. As I said before, I was a violent offender. Everything about me was very confrontational, defensive. I was always willing to fight and always willing to be up for that confrontation. And so learning why I was so angry, why I was so defensive, and learning more about myself, that whole self-awareness and insight into oneself, that was huge for me, as I think it is for everybody, right? I think this journey is about learning who you are and why you tick and what you can do to grow and change. I can remember feeling the freedom of not having to be angry anymore. I could smile again. I could be happy. I could be joyful. I could crack jokes and make people laugh and laugh with others. I can remember the first belly laugh and how awesome that felt to just be able to be happy and okay. So, yeah.
Was that transformation, from violent and confrontational and just that angry feeling to that happiness, was that transformation difficult?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Most people, if they get to a treatment court program, they've experienced quite a bit of trauma. And so my mindset was, if I was tough enough that they saw, they wouldn't mess with me. I've been a victim of sexual assault, of abusive relationships, of just violent events where I was then caught off guard in an effort to not be hurt, to not be messed with. I thought I had to be the one that was tougher. And so I became the violent, the confrontational, the what I thought I needed to be so people wouldn't mess with me. And so that was a hard persona to shed, because then I felt vulnerable, weak, easy target, someone that someone might come after. And it was hard to let go of some of those masks that I wore because I thought that's what I needed to protect me. Based on some of the things I went through. So diving into a lot of that stuff was tough. It was hard.
Sorry. I'm over here
Lying
taking
any
deep breaths like I'm
stuff.
telling my story or something, but just wow. Just wow, Jennifer. I'm really hoping that somebody's listening to this and in the future, and is just really inspired by your words and the path that you took and the journey that you were on, because it's not easy. It's not easy, and it's simple to create these programs. I say simple, I mean, they're always complicated in itself to create a program, but you create a program, and many people think, we're going to create this program, we're going to help people. But the reality is that the people who need the most help, it's not an easy process. It's not something that's going to happen quickly. And it's not. I mean, there's just so much to address, that led you there in that moment, right, in life. And so the whole point is that the program is focusing on addressing those things, on addressing, like you said, to help you identify why are you responding that way? Why are you, feeling the way that you feel that's leading you to these behaviors? Because most of this behavior is just a product of something else, right? It's often not a reflection of who you actually are as a person. It's often a reflection of what's happened in your life before that, And so
Absolutely. If you're in a treatment court, you were somebody that somebody told along the way that you're never going to be anything. You're always going to screw up. You're never going to get sober. You're never going to be good at anything because it's that high risk, high need, right? The system, you've already been to prison. You've already seen the inside of a county jail more times than you can count. You've lost everything. You're cold. You're broken. you've been through so much that has just put you to pieces, that you develop a hard outer shell. And that is hard to break through and put those pieces together. You know, I give it to the teams that come together to help people that were like me, right? That's not an easy job either. It may be hard for the participants, but it's really hard to work with those participants too, to try to understand them, because the way they behave, the way they tick, the words they say, they don't make it easy. I didn't make it easy on our team. And I see participants that don't make it easy still today, right? But that's part of the job. That's what people in treatment courts have stepped up to do. And how can I not try to be a part of some of that, right? And I think it's amazing. You know, before we had a treatment court in this county, you know, we as offenders, as repeat offenders, as addicts, we already knew if you got in trouble, you were going to prison or you were going to be on probation and probably not be successful, right? We always said probation was a setup for failure. To change the mindset that I had with that treatment court program, I'll buy in forever. I believe it can help anybody. And I think it's amazing that these exist for repeat offenders, for people who are constantly in and out of trouble, who struggle with addiction and mental health. These are miracle programs for people like me.
Do you, with your alumni group, and like the aftercare that you're doing, do you guys do any like sober events at all?
Oh yeah. So we try to do different events every time. So like on the fifth week of this month, we're going to have an alumni speaker and kind of like a potluck style buffet thing. And then in April, we're going to all get together and go bowling. We've gone into like a baseball game, Rockhounds game before. They've got together and went to the rage room where they get to smash a bunch of stuff together. We've done putt-putt green golf. You know, we've done so many different things. There's groups that get together and go to movies. So yeah, we try to create that connection in those events to show people that they can do those things sober, because I couldn't imagine going to a Rockhounds game without going to Thirsty Thursday. Show up for Thirsty Thursday and leave once they start selling alcohol. I don't even remember the game. Didn't even stay till the end of the game. That wasn't the point of going. And so I couldn't imagine going and not being messed up. When we all got together and we've gone to several of these baseball games, it's been really cool. It was eye-opening for me to see that I could have fun without drugs and alcohol. Bowling was one of those things too. And bowling is my favorite event. And so we're going to have a lot of fun. I'm excited for April.
You mentioned earlier about the housing, like if you could have a sober living for the program, that would be ideal. Are there any other resources that you think would enhance the program now, having gone through it yourself and being a person who actually helps other people continue to go through it and seeing how it's grown over the past several years? Is there any resources or community resources that you wish existed that could make that program even more successful for people?
You know, definitely different housing options, but even more than that, mental health options. You know, I love that we have the resources that we have, but it's hard for those that struggle with mental health. The resources, the state-funded resources, they're not the easiest to get involved with. It's a high anxiety environment to sit and wait all day to be evaluated. There's not a whole lot of like an outpatient, there really is none. No outpatient treatment for mental health, like education groups or topic discussions or peer groups just for mental health. So I would say that would be a resource that would benefit and enhance and empower participants if there was better and more available indigent resources for mental health.
That's a good one. I know you're in school, and we kind of talked about that actually, unless there is anything you can think of to share about any future plans for either the program or for yourself or anything that we talked about today that you want to talk about at all.
So, I don't know what the future holds for me. I am doing my best to stay out of the way and let God lead. I know he's got some big things in store, and I'm super excited for what the future holds. But I try to just stay in the moment, right? Stay in the moment and reach out to those participants, do the work that I'm doing, be involved in the recovery community. I'm really praying about, you know, enhancement and improvement for our alumni program, so we're able to do more and be more for the current participants, and a way of connection after the program. I really, you know, feel that that's going to be something in the future that's going to be really amazing. I have no idea where he's going to leave me with school. No idea. But I'm excited to see, right? I know there's going to be different opportunities that come along, and I'm ready for them. I'm ready to see what he has in store.
All right. So I always like to wrap up asking for three recommendations. So I always ask for a tip, a resource, and an event. Things that you can recommend to somebody else who's in a similar role to you, whether that be somebody who's a participant or somebody who is a peer recovery or support specialist, whichever role it is, basically, that you think somebody else should know about and consider. What kind of tip could you share with people?
I'm also well involved now with the National Treatment Court Alumni Association, the NTCAA. And so if I could give any type of tip to other courts, is one, really think about this peer specialist role or an alumni being a part of the team. Really think about that, because it's so impactful and so beneficial. And if you don't have an alumni group, the NTCAA is there to help support you build one. I am so grateful to be part of such a brand new rising organization that's empowering alumni of treatment courts all across the country. I am excited with what they have in the future and to keep going with them. But absolutely, it's the alumni. If you don't have one, get one. It's help empower some of your participants to build one. That connection is so needed. And if you're not working with a peer specialist or you do not have an alumni to be a voice on the team, definitely think about implementing that or creating space for that, because it's beneficial and impactful for not only the team, but for the participants and the whole process itself.
That's a good tip. What about a resource?
Well, I'm going to go right back into the NTCAA. They're an amazing new resource. They signed, anybody was at All Rise in Houston last year, they got to sign an MOU with All Rise to work hand in hand to help create these, help support other courts to help them build alumni programs. But they are super amazing. So if you do not know about the NTCAA, I am happy to share information about that. They've got a Facebook page, National Treatment Court Alumni Association. They have space for everybody as members. You can be part of the team. You can be, you know, a family or loved one that supports. And you can be an alumni of the program. But they're an amazing new resources that are help supporting treatment courts across the country. So again, if you don't know who they are, I have information for it and how to get involved. So I'd be happy to give that to anybody.
Perfect. And I will actually be including that link in our show notes as well. Help people get to their website. What about an event?
So I'm excited about the task conference. Me and a representative from Thriving United, and then my supervisor, Ashley, and the agency director, and then judge, will all be presenting on how to use live peer mentors in a treatment court setting. So I'm hoping we'll get to meet lots of people. And I'll get to share some of what I've shared here today in that presentation as well. I'm also going to be at All Rise with the NTCAA, and I'm going to be a part of their presentation and how to build an alumni group, how to start an alumni group. And so I'm really excited about being at the All Rise with the NTCAA and get more involved with that organization. Two exciting events, task conference next week. Oh, wow, it is next week. So next week, hopefully to meet a lot of people during that presentation and even connect in different breakout sessions and all that good stuff. But I will also be at All Rise, and I am super excited to go to California. I've never been, so definitely excited for that.
Well, this will probably air after the task conference, but it'll be, you know, at task conference comes around every year. I'm going to be at the task conference, and I'm looking forward to meeting you in person.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I will seek you out.
I'll be the one wandering around.
Me too, probably.
So Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the show, being vulnerable, sharing your story, and
For sure.
just having a passion to lift others up and to help other people, and just pouring your heart into this community and to people who really do need that support that you're sharing. And I just thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing your story with us.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed this conversation with you. I appreciate the opportunity. I love talking about this stuff. I have a huge passion for it, so I'm here
Yes.
for it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Podtask, a show promoting healthy communities through innovative treatment within the Texas Specialty Court programs. The Podtask is presented by the Texas Association of Specialty Courts, also known as TASC, TASC. You can learn more about TASC at www.tasctx.org.